Okay, so firstly I'll ask a few questions to do with your earlier work with ancient civilizations, just to get it all out of the way, because that's what you're doing at the moment. Some information that's come out since you've stopped doing non-fiction work on that, well, not since, but I mean, mm-hmm. you sort of didn't do work on it, is Göbekli Tepe and Kartal Hoyuk.
Yes.
What do you make of these? I mean, I see them as pretty important. I mean, Göbekli Tepe is dated to 10,000 BC, so it's almost a smoking gun.
It really is. Yeah, I see it as important too. I was aware of Kartal Hoyuk when I wrote Fingerprints of the Gods. I didn't go into it. In the later book, Underworld, I considered the implications of sites of similar antiquity to Kartal Hoyuk in the Indus Valley civilization, or the precursors to the Indus Valley civilization. But the real breakthrough is Göbekli Tepe, which I don't think people have yet quite realized why Göbekli Tepe is so important. And the first reason is that it begins to provide a context for other structures of dubious date. Yeah. For example, the Sphinx.
One of the big things was find me another site that's the same age.
Find me another site that's the same age. This is the big argument with the Sphinx, that one of the reasons why we couldn't possibly accept it's 12,000 plus years old is because there is no other site like that. Well, now we have a massive megalithic site with obelisks, with not obelisks, but megalithic blocks weighing in some cases, I believe, up to 50 tons each. Yeah. Which is securely dated to around 10,000 BC, 12,000 years old, and clearly there has to be a background to
exactly. this. Exactly. I mean, that's what I was going to mention, was the archaeologists working on it. Well, not the archaeologists working on it, but the people talking about it, which is not many, which is quite surprising. I mean, not many people.
It's had very little attention. Yeah.
But they don't seem to really implicate the fact that there must have been a settled civilization there doing this.
Yeah.
You know, they don't really point out that. I mean, carvings of that style and time, and I mean, megalithic building. And I mean, you know, they've uncovered what, two circles, and they think there's 20 or 21. Mm. You know, that's a long settled civilization there. You don't just pop that overnight. You know?
Well, it's not only that. It's not only a long settled civilization there. It's we would expect that they practiced those skills over a long period of time. And therefore, there must be other sites in which we can see the progression.
And
we don't know where those sites are.
Yeah.
So it's like it appears there suddenly with no apparent antecedents.
Yeah.
And this raises the possibility that the antecedents lie in a lost civilization.
Yeah.
And that this may be the first really solid glimpse of the existence of such a civilization. And the other thing that intrigues me about Göbekli Tepe is that some of the motifs are quite similar to the images that you find on the painted caves,
which
we do know go back to a much earlier date, back as old as 35,000 years. But never has there been associated with that culture large-scale construction and organization. So it seems to bring in something from what we would call the Upper Paleolithic, so-called hunter-gatherer culture, but nevertheless operating with very high-level skills, making megalithic sites, and so maybe
one developed them over a long period,
it's the mixture of these high-level skills with Upper Paleolithic motifs that makes me think something really intriguing is going on here. But I don't know what.
Really needs to be done on that side.
It does,
with Kartal Hoyuk as well.
I'm hoping to get there this year with a bit of luck.
Just speaking of the Sphinx, I mean, obviously this is giving some context to the age of the Sphinx that is, I mean, geologically it's almost undeniable at this point.
Yeah.
What do you make of the idea that with the Sphinx, if it falls into the period of sort of 10,500, 11,500 BC time frame, at the time, obviously, I mean, in Underworld you go into this in depth, but at the time there were global floods, massive upheaval, that maybe a culture wouldn't have done that at that time, and you might have to go back another whole processional cycle?
I don't feel the need to do that. Okay. My friend John Anthony West does. He thinks the Sphinx is, we need to push it back more than 30,000 years.
And I mean, that coincides with the King List.
It coincides with the King List. There are some reasons to to do that. You see the fact is that but I can't rule that out either.
Yeah.
Sure. The fact is that all we can say is that the Sphinx was exposed to heavy rains 9 or 10,000 years ago.
Yeah.
That simply tells us that it was already there then. But
can't say
how long before then it was there. Who knows? Perhaps it was already an ancient monument 12,500 years ago. It is possible. It is possible. And that area we do know was never covered by ice sheets. It could have been worked on at any time in that period.
Yeah. And another question on the weathering there, which I've had since I sort of found Schock's work and John Anthony West, which was that when we speak of the weathering there to date, there's the two main types of weathering, which is the water weathering on the enclosure and the body.
Yeah.
And then the depth weathering in the floor.
Yeah.
And something that always made me sort of a little uneasy with the dating there is that when you look at the seismological surveys that they did there for the depth weathering, it's deeper at the front and higher at the back. And, you know, Schock intimates that perhaps the front end was carved out 10, however long, 1,000 years ago. I mean, he goes to 7,000,
and the rear end later.
And the rear was later, but then... Yeah. The water weathering on the enclosure walls are
very pronounced at the back.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I've always, obviously, the person who talked to would be shocked.
Yeah, I can't really give you further on that. I agree with you that it's a problem.
Sure.
The issue that's most obvious to the naked eye is the water weathering.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's all around the Sphinx.
Yeah.
On the core body, except it's very difficult to see the core body because it's covered up with later restoration blocks.
Yeah. And I agree. I mean, we've spoken on this tour a number of times, and we've mentioned, and I definitely agree that there's a lot more to be discovered in Giza.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea what else might be there? I mean, what else might be part of some sort of complex?
I think we have to again take ancient Egyptian traditions into account. This is the land of Rosnau. This is the underworld on Earth, this is the Duat on the ground. And therefore we would expect to find a labyrinth of corridors, passageways, chambers, tunnels underneath Giza. That we would it would absolutely astonish me if that's not there, because I'm quite convinced that one of the functions of these monuments, and I think they're multifunctional, but one of the functions of them was to serve as a physical representation of this realm through which we are expected to make our journey after death. I think at the moment we're just seeing the above surface parts of it.
Right.
And I think that there's a whole massive complex underneath.
Sort of ideas.
But I also think that some of that ancient complex, I think that personally for me, the most ancient part of the Giza Plateau is the subterranean chamber in the Great Pyramid.
Yeah.
I think that the Egyptologists are quite wrong to suggest that was built by the pharaoh.
I definitely agree with that.
And, you know, there's a little passage going off south from there, ends in a dead end.
Yes.
I don't know why that's there or what's past that or what we're going to find, but it's an issue which has been surrounded by a great deal of secrecy.
Yeah.
And misinformation. It may well be that this cave underworld has already been found. And by the way, you do need to look at Andy Collins' book.
Yes, I've seen
which
the Tomb of the Birds cave.
Exactly.
And I mean, more work needs to be done there. I mean, it's been found.
Yeah.
You know, you need to see how far that goes and what's in there.
So I if you get a chance, I would try and talk to Andy Collins.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask.
I can connect you with him
and see if I can get in touch with him.
Yeah, I'll be happy to connect you with him.
And one more quick question on Giza, which is, what's your take on what might be up the star shaft? I mean, you know, the second tour there.
We know that at the bottom of the shaft is a large chamber, which we call the Queen's Chamber these days. So there's no reason why there shouldn't be a large chamber at the top of it too. I've always felt that one of the functions of these shafts was to encourage curiosity.
Right.
We're supposed to explore.
You say in your talk, you know, it seems to be telling us.
Yeah, it's an invitation.
Me, you know.
It's an invitation. Search me, but it won't be easy. And I will require you to be ingenious.
Yeah.
And maybe I'll require more of you than that too.
Right.
There may be spiritual requirements in this. Yeah.
Two more questions on that front. One of them is just sort of a personal one. What are your favourite sites in the world to visit? You know, maybe one or two in the world, you know, not just here in Egypt.
Yeah, well, I love Easter Island.
Right.
I love Angkor in Cambodia. Malta is a stunning and mysterious place.
I went there when I was a little kid, but I didn't know anything about this sort of stuff.
So amazing. There's a very, very mysterious megalithic constructions all over Malta, which have a special power and magic about them.
There as well, and that seems to indicate, you know, something.
Absolutely. There's a lot of stuff underwater in Malta. And then, of course, I mean, I really can't. I don't think that Yonaguni, for those of us who can dive, that Yonaguni in Japan can be equaled. It's just a stunning. For all monuments,
really?
It's a stunning, stunning place to visit.
I haven't dived there.
Yeah,
so.
It's just an incredibly powerful and wonderful place. And nearby where I live, the sacred site of Avebury, a 6,000-year-old stone circle, is also one of my favorite places on earth.
Right. And I've never heard you mention this, but that I'm not saying that you don't know about it, but this kind of runs on from Easter Island and the site of Nan Madol. There is some evidence that I've seen, it's only really come out in the last sort of decade or so, of older Celtic culture in New Zealand.
But, Celtic?
Yeah.
I know nothing about this.
They've found remnants of Maoris that have red hair.
Right.
There's passage graves that look a lot like the Celtic graves.
Some gigantic wall as well.
The Kaimanawa Wall. And that was actually really strange, because there's a lot of secrecy around that. When it was first found, Maoris have basically divided up New Zealand into their sections. It's their land, and you're not allowed to sort of do anything on it. Mm-hmm. And when it was first found, they said, this has nothing to do with us, we don't care. You know, it's probably just igneous rock or something.
Yeah.
And then they brought geologists in, and they said, wait a minute, we need to look at this seriously. We need to excavate this and see if there's anything behind it or below the ground. Mm-hmm. And as soon as they set a date to do an excavation, the Maoris came in and said, no, this is on our land, you can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
So they haven't done any excavations on it.
Right, so there's nothing further been done.
We can't really say what that is.
I don't know anything about this Celtic thing. Right. I'm less interested anyway in the color of people's hair than in the nature of their ideas.
Yeah.
And ideas are what travel, irrespective of, you know, genetic traces. So I've never been much interested in, you know, can I trace the movements of a particular DNA or type or ethnic group.
Yeah.
Because in my experience, really what moves across human culture are ideas, and they're quite separate from DNA.
And we saw at Elephant Arena, I mentioned to you that the face there, though, it's a lot like the faces on the Cambodian.
You did,
Cambodian things at Angkor. It just interests me, I'll just mention in passing, that they also have the same block joining technique.
The eye-shaped bar.
In South America you have the eye-shaped ones, and in Cambodia and here...
We've seen them all over the world, we've seen them in Cambodia. We've seen them all over South America, we've seen them all over Egypt. You'll see them at Dendera when you go there, just go up on the roof, you'll see them all over the place.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, let's move off that topic and move into something that you've been doing a bit more recently. So, ayahuasca, it's been a big part of your research, a big part of your life.
Yeah.
And Mother Ayahuasca, you know, it's the spirit of ayahuasca. What do you think is the main reason that Mother Ayahuasca is reaching out to people and touching people at this time, specifically at this
time? I think of the spirit behind ayahuasca as the spirit of our planet. I think this is, for me, she's the mother goddess of this planet, and is particularly attached to and involved with the rainforests, which must be understood as sacred zones. They must not be understood as resources.
Absolutely.
These are sacred realms. And I think that one of the things that ayahuasca is doing is the spirit of the rainforest speaking back to us. It's very difficult for people who are rooted and grounded in the materialist tradition to conceive of something like trees having spirit. But I believe that they're filled with spirit, and that the agony that we are inflicting on these rainforests now has finally produced a reaction, and that reaction is that the rainforests themselves, through their own products, through the particular plants, the Cicotria viridis and the Banisteriopsis carpi that are found in the Amazon, have found a way to speak to us.
Right.
They found a way to speak to human consciousness, because there is this, it is very difficult for spirit to speak to matter and for matter to speak to spirit. It's not impossible, everything is connected, but actually the lines of communication are extremely difficult, and spirit cannot manifest material.
Yes.
This is what's clear to me. It cannot Mother Ayahuasca cannot step in and physically stop us from destroying the planet. But what she can do is reach us at the level of consciousness. And at the level of consciousness, what she's doing all over the world is changing the way that people think about the role of humanity on this planet. They are causing people to ask questions, causing people to say no to the standard model, causing people to think again. In a curious kind of way, this is the rainforest fighting back.
Right. And that follows on to another question I had, which is, it's a relatively cliche question, but I was just quite interested on your take on it, which is, do you think, and if you do, in what sort of manner do you think that spirit and science can meet in any sort of meaningful way?
Well, I don't see any reason why we need to jettison the scientific approach. I think the scientific approach is extremely appropriate to the realm of matter.
Of course.
I have no objection to a scientific approach to the realm of spirit either. I would like to see more work done with multiple volunteers in the exploration of the spirit realm. And I think that could be done in a targeted scientific manner. I think we'd benefit from
it. Yeah, well, I mean, looking at Rich Strassman's work, I mean, came out with some pretty astounding results.
He opened the door, but it didn't go nearly far enough.
No,
and,
that's
and
true.
Much more work could be done because I'm clear in my own mind, I can't prove this, but I'm clear in my own mind that altered states of consciousness are fundamental to our connection with the spirit realm. And through the visionary plants, it is actually possible pretty much to turn on an altered state of consciousness at will.
Yeah.
Through other techniques like meditation or rhythmic dancing, it's not so easy to make it just happen, you know, when you want.
But you are adept at those things, you can't
get enough people who are adept at
things. No, absolutely.
I don't see it as a contradiction in terms. I see that the so-called scientific method has much utility.
Yeah.
But I, unlike most scientists, I don't see it as the only method available to us.
Right.
I see it as part of a toolkit that we have been equipped with by the universe. And the mistake we're making right now is placing way too much reliance on the scientific method and
that state of consciousness.
And not only on the scientific method, but also you have to understand that there are certain fundamental assumptions rooted into science. And one of those assumptions is that there is no spirit realm. There is no spirit.
I'm absolutely with you. I mean,
this is not a scientific fact, but it is a fundamental assumption of science. And I think science needs to, if science is to make progress, it needs to actually cut that. It needs to cut that off and say that, and stop building in preconceived notions. It needs to actually examine itself, because it's unscientific.
Yeah.
To say there is no spirit world.
Absolutely, and I mean, when millions of people are coming back and saying, I've been there, I mean, you have to at least consider that on a serious level.
I mean,
obviously you don't have to say, okay, it's there, but you do have to at least consider that on a very serious level.
Definitely. Same goes with near-death experiences, which again, science is opposed to the notion that there might be any form of survival of death. But this opposition is not based on any fact or any investigation. It's based on prejudice.
So
for science to be truly useful, it needs to actually get rid of its own prejudices.
Yeah.
And that's apparently a very difficult thing for it to do.
And I mean, that's obviously quite obvious in the ancient civilization sort of ideas as well. You know, the assumption is that they're not there, so if the evidence comes up, it's assumed the evidence is wrong rather than the
evidence. Again and again.
You run into that.
But science has its place, and it's a very helpful tool for investigating the material realm.
Well, of course. I mean, otherwise you just have any old theory coming up every here and there, and you have things like Christianity running around and killing people, destroying good ideas.
Sure.
So on a personal level, as opposed to on a sort of global a level of reason. What do you think is the main benefit of going to these worlds and bringing ideas back?
It's very clear to me that we are involved with those realms whether we like it or not.
Yeah.
We are immersed in them as you immerse somebody in a bath. We're completely immersed in, for want of a better word, the supernatural.
Right.
And therefore, if we wish to function effectively, we cannot close ourselves off from those realms. We can't actually close ourselves off from them.
Whether we
choose to or not, they are part of our lives. So we might as well be proactive and get to grips with those realms and understand the effects that they have on us and the effects that we have on them.
This is why
we in the West really have a learning experience to go through with shamanism, because shamanism is the system that gets to grips with the supernatural. And I'm using that word in inverted commas because I think everything is natural, actually.
Absolutely. But
within our framework, within our framework, we call it the supernatural. We really have to get to grips with that, and much of the problem in the world today is from absolute denial of the existence of spirit, which has allowed all kinds of negative spiritual forces to get to work in our societies.
And I think it's quite interesting, and I mean it ties into this really well. I mean, the idea that you've been bringing up, that we are inexplicably tied to these realms, whether we want to or not, is that we have a gland that appears to be producing
which is the vehicle that
takes you there.
Exactly, which is the nexus between us and these realms.
Yeah.
Our evolution has actually designed us to connect with these realms.
Yeah.
So it's a willful stupidity not to do so.
Yeah.
It's a huge error. So I think the benefit that the visionary plants offer to the modern world is that they offer us a system of reconnecting with these realms. And if you like, a technology for reconnecting with these realms.
Do you think it's possible that perhaps at some point in the distant past, I mean, maybe in these cultures that we speak of, and the civilization work that you've done and that I'm getting into, do you think it's possible that these cultures put more emphasis on this than we do? Do you think they might have had
a much
larger connection with the spirit realm and use that to their own benefit?
Much more. You only need to look at ancient Egypt to see that what an incredibly successful culture that was. Incredibly successful culture for making human beings happy.
Yeah.
Thousands of years at peace and were recognized by other cultures at the time as the happiest people in the world.
Yeah.
Totally fulfilled.
Yeah.
They sorted out the material realm completely. A lot of people accuse the ancient Egyptians of being stuck in the mud. Why did they never change? Why did they need to change something
exactly.
that was perfect?
They would have changed if they had to.
Yeah, it worked perfectly.
Yeah.
And why did they need to change it? So what you find in this culture is a beautiful mixture of scientific rationalism and spirit merged together into a system that was incredibly successful for 3,000 years.
Right. A big question that I've been thinking about a lot recently, I mean, but since I've sort of had changes in my own life where I've come into a much more healthy state of being with everybody around me, my relationships and myself, is the use of the word love. Which I think there's two very different types of love, which is conditional love and unconditional love.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that throughout history, the bastardization of the word love has really put a massive block between people actually connecting with a feeling of unconditional love, where you are actually connected with the world and connected with people that you interact with, as opposed to attached to people that you interact with and things that you interact with as well. I mean, people say, you know, I love my car, I love my house, I love...
Sure, it's a much abused word.
I love money, you know, whatever it is. I mean, what do you feel is a useful way to use the term? I mean, what do you think is a useful way to use it that's actually helpful for people and conducive for people to have happy and healthy lives? It's a big question.
Well, I think it involves controlling your own actions and behavior, so that the impact you have on others is positive and beneficial for them, rather than necessarily for you. I think it's it's the hardest thing in the world to do. It's not responding to hate with hate, but responding to it with the opposite. It's a very difficult, very difficult and impossible, almost impossible task for human beings to accomplish. But it's obvious to me at a plain common sense level.
Yeah.
Actually, that if you went back to the original teachings of Jesus,
yes,
other than the teachings that have been, you know, acquired by the church, if you went back to those simple teachings, and if we ran our lives along those lines, things would be pretty good.
I think it's quite telling in that context that, I mean, things like the Essene Gospels and the Nakamadi texts have been almost ritualistically repressed through history.
Totally repressed.
That's where you get the real core of what he was teaching, and I absolutely agree. I think if you really look at the Bible, you're going to get a lot of good things out of it. It's just if you have people like priests telling you how to think about the Bible and telling you how to talk about the Bible, then you're going to end up with a very twisted version of it.
In the words of Christ himself, I can't find anything except love. It's all there.
And yet,
those words have been used as a vehicle for hate so much throughout the world.
Oh, absolutely.
So, you know, we have to disregard the apparatus and look at the actual words, and there's a great teacher of love there. What else? It's not adding to misery of the world.
Absolutely.
First and foremost, that's something, and that's an act of love too.
Yeah,
that's something that any human being can make the choice to do, not make things worse. I don't think we need to have these vast, vaunting ambitions.
No.
If we just start at the level of, this person, undertake not to make things worse.
Yes.
That alone.
I'll act lovingly instead of.
Yes, yes. As much as it's possible to do.
And I think
it's very difficult to love somebody who fucks you up.
And acts
maliciously against you.
Yes, I mean, I was just about to say, I think one of the most important.
And I have a real hard job doing that myself. Yeah.
I was going to say one of the most important things is that love those who stand with you, absolutely, but I think it's more important to love those who stand against you. Because if these are people that are acting in this way, if they're not loving themselves, how are they ever going to change their ways if they don't have don't have the love given to them as well?
Sure.
And I agree. I mean, it's incredibly hard to do that, and it's incredibly hard to look at yourself and say, I am not being loving. I mean, everyone likes to think that what they're doing is the right thing and that they're being helpful.
Sure.
And I think it's one of the hardest things to be truly reflective and actually look at your actions and say, hang on a minute, I'm not actually doing this the way I either would like to be doing it, or I've been telling myself I've been doing it.
Yeah. It's about us and other people. Fundamentally, is this thing that I'm doing helpful and beneficial for that person, or negative? If it's negative, it's not love.
And
but we're all so mired in.
Yeah.
It's so easy to say and so difficult to do.
Exactly.
Really.
Exactly. And this ties in with another question, which I'll ask. Using ayahuasca, simply because it's something that you've had a lot of experience with, I've had a lot of experience with psilocybin mushrooms and mescaline and LSD, and from different viewpoints, obviously, but I mean, with you, it's ayahuasca.
I know the other substances too, yeah.
This ties in a lot with the type of messages you get given in the spirit realm. I mean, one of the biggest things that you get is you get confronted with the way that you are, and what's wrong, not necessarily what's wrong with it, inverted commas.
Well,
but
yeah, even what's wrong with it.
What isn't helpful?
Yeah, and what isn't helpful? What doesn't serve you? What doesn't serve others?
And the planet as well. I mean, it all has to work as one.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily just making sure humans are happy. I mean, the whole lot needs to be working together for it to actually work.
Totally. Yeah.
And in concert with that, I think bringing back messages like you have, I mean, when you give your talks, you're very impassioned in the messages that you've been given, and I think that's a very good thing, because when you don't have examples like that, you don't have people saying, look, not the answer is here, but you can use these plants as tools to help yourself be more loving,
to self-diagnose, to understand your impact, to understand what you're doing to people around you.
Yes.
They're very, very helpful for that.
And in that way, I think being that only some people are open to these experiences. I mean, a lot of people have a prejudice from when they're very young that these plants are drugs,
yes.
And that's all they are, and they are going to screw with your mind,
mm.
and you're going to come back with mm. wacko ideas, and you're going to screw everything up.
Mm.
I think it's really important that you have people like yourself in the public light, obviously, but I mean,
yeah.
anybody who's been to these realms and come back, to be able to shed this light
yeah.
on people that they interact with and people that they love or hate.
Sure.
I mean, either way,
sure.
To be able to show it's, that this light is there.
Yeah, it is important to do that, and we all have a responsibility to do that. And the one thing that I think it's quite important to point out to people who are blocked in this area, who say, no, these are drugs, this is bad, this is wicked, this is wrong. The thing to make clear to those people is that the society and the social structures that have labeled these things as evil, look at what that society and those social structures actually do. Look at the harm and the pain and the damage. The very instruments of the war on drugs are themselves implicated in the most horrific acts on the planet. This is a culture that makes war on a gigantic scale, that dominates and controls, that ruthlessly rips off other cultures and peoples, and yet it tells you that these plants are evil.
Yeah.
Now when you realize that the voice that is telling you these plants are evil is actually emanating from pure evil
just
itself,
as a logical
then you have to realize that the statement is false.
Yeah.
That we're being misled.
I mean, just as a logical observation, you look at war and you think, well, perhaps war would be reduced if these worlds were opened up.
Of course it would.
And the general feeling of unease as well.
Might see you later.
Right.
Are you going to come in?
Later? Might do. Yeah.
Half six.
We might see you there.
The general dis-ease with which people live.
Mm.
I mean, even if you're not going to look at the apparatus in which the societal norms are generated, just the dis-ease in which most people live. I mean,
sure.
they go about their lives going to work, coming home, yelling at their kids,
yeah.
in trouble with their cars,
yeah, very unhappy with their lives,
treating their pets badly, which
yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, all of these things are horrible. And I mean, just on a very basic level, it's astounding to me, but I'm sure there's a very real problem at the core of it, that people can't stop and say, this isn't working for me.
No.
There needs to be something different to show us the way forward.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think you're doing a very good job in that respect.
Thank you.
And that.
Thank you. I have some function in that area as an elder, which
yes,
is what
yes.
I am these days. And giving a point of view which is not often heard, I would say.
Yeah.
In this
absolutely.
Society of ours.
And I thank you very much for that, and thank you very much for your time as well.
My pleasure.
Thank you very
My
much.
My pleasure.
Absolutely.
It's good to talk to you.
Thank you very much.